You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
Yes, which way, what, when, how? Mr. Otto D, flip the track right now.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in on this gorgeous Monday evening here in Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Daniolo, broadcasting from Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Network Studios high above Camelback Road. And my guest this evening, Felix Sainz, is a multi-instrumentalist and multilingual vocalist singing songs in four different languages. Besides being an incredible musician and singer, he's also a wonderful human being with a great voice for radio, as you'll see. So first, I'd like to set the mood with one of Felix's favorite cuts from back in the day. This is a tune by Grady Tate titled Sack Full of Dreams.
I've got a dream for the world, peace in the rivers and everywhere, bridges of steel and love, and cities that smile. Gray, empty faces walk by. Hands try to hide all the loneliness, lighting their cigarettes to blow time away. Lost in the noise, lonely as wind, people on sidewalks with no place to go. Can they learn to understand? A dream for the world, kites flying hope through a summer sky, corners where children play and run in the rain, I've got a sack full of dreams, streets filled with laughter and toy balloons, people with hearts that care, who listen for love, wanting to sing, wanting to care, wanting to share all my dreams for the world. Will they learn to understand? I'm dreaming. This is my sack full of dreams.
You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
And that was Sack Full of Dreams by Grady Tate here on the Otto D Show, which is brought to you by Trattoria D'Amico in Ahwatukee, an authentic Italian restaurant where you'll often find me right after the show. They're on the north side of Warner Road, just west of I-10. Stop in and tell them Otto sent you. And now I'd like to welcome to the show a wonderful musician and singer as well, a good friend, Mr. Felix Sainz. Felix, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Thanks for coming. I'm good. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's always fun when we get to sit for a little bit before the show and chat, and all these great stories come out. And sometimes I feel like I should record the pre-show chat just for everybody to get to catch a bit of that as well. But tell me a little bit about what you got going on these days. You're in a couple different groups, playing lots of different shows.
Working fairly regularly with the Beth Lederman, working with Diana Lee, Dennis Rowland, Rick Palalay and his group, there's Don Wild and many other local favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess they like me because they keep calling me, so I'm
That's
grateful
a good
for
thing.
That.
Yeah. And there was a couple names I saw, the Trio.
Trio 380.
380.
Yeah. Well, interesting story behind that group. I worked with them for many, many years, probably going on my second decade with them. And we actually used to work... Every Saturday, not far from here, over at Nordstrom's on Saturdays for many years, and then run to the next gig, which is over at the Casinos, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
So I work with that group, and now we're still doing things together, and after many years, doing some shows out in Fountain Hills, out in Far West Valley, Sun City Grand, that kind of stuff. Novo Mundo, that's Beth Lederman and Kay Pepper were the co-leaders in that group. That's kind of evolved into something now. It's called Jazz Con Alma, and I work with them. It's private events, and we have a concert coming up at the Church of the Beatitudes here this month.
Okay.
And so we do like Desert Botanical Garden, those type of gigs, you know, still private events and stuff.
Okay. Now, you've been playing music for a while. How old were you when you started?
Well, 8 years old when I first started playing music. Learned how to read music. It was a program, summer program. I was, you know, growing up in Glendale.
Okay. Are you originally from Arizona?
I was born in Phoenix.
Okay.
Yeah,
Phoenix. One of the few.
Yeah. Parents originally from New Mexico. They moved here in the 50s. And so, humble beginnings.
So you're 8 years old.
I was, I was 8 years old. I was an altar boy, riding my bike every morning before school, 6:30 mass, learn how to do Latin, you know, the Latin, mass in Latin. And then we'd do the, that was every day.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then go to, you know, go to school, or in the summer we had the recreation, they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had like a foosball table in the corner and board games and stuff like that. But the one year, that year, Don Bothwell and Jeff Jeffries, some of you might know who that is, great teachers, great mentors. They were young men at the time. They came to the school, and they brought three cornets and three clarinets, and there must have been 20 kids that came out to, they wanted to learn how to play. So in between each student's turn, they dipped the mouthpiece in mouthwash, sanitize it, and then everybody got their turn. But they taught us how to read music, and we ended up playing, at the time, you know, Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass were popular, so we would play those songs, and theme from Batman, theme from Hawaii Five-O, remember that one?
Yeah,
so we used to do that.
Very cool. And how long did you play brass?
I played brass up until the first year of high school. And by that time, I had already been picking up on guitar and had kind of built my own bass, kind of repurposed an old guitar into a bass at that time.
Oh, really?
So, but I was playing cornet in early years. We had music as part of our curriculum in the Isaac Imes school, which was, we had our own little school there, all the Latinos growing up there for many generations. Okay. I was a new guy, so I was a new kid here. But great school, great teachers.
Big family?
Small family, relatively. I have two siblings.
Okay.
I'm the oldest of three.
And were you the only one playing music?
No, I think we all had our turn at it. You know, my sister played clarinet when she was very young, and my brother played trombone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, you say you moved into guitar while you were still playing the cornet, and you actually repurposed a guitar into a bass.
Well, you know, in high school, you know, things change. You know, I think I was still in middle school when I actually was my first garage band playing a trumpet.
Okay. And I played trumpet coming up in grade school.
Yeah.
Played the same stuff. Was inspired by Herb Alpert and Al Hurt, actually.
Right.
And then a kid brought a guitar in for show and tell in sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Played Jingle Bells.
Uh-oh.
Girls went crazy.
Of course.
And I saw that the guitar was cooler than the trumpet.
Well, that I have a similar story.
So I wondered if that was kind of the same line there. So you say you were in your first little garage band in high school. Do you remember what the name was?
We never really got that far.
Okay.
At time, I grew up in a Mexican-American community.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the time, a good friend of mine, he was a little older than me, and his cousin was having what they call a quinceañera, kind of the equivalent of a debutante. ceremony. And so they were kind of trying to get us worked up to where we could play at her event.
Sure.
And so we were learning, you know, Motown gigs and Motown music and a mixture of Mexican-American type music, some love songs and stuff. So that's kind of where I actually picked up the bass first time.
Mm-hmm.
Because the bass player couldn't remember the part. It was Just My Imagination by Temptations. Couldn't remember the doom 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 doom. He couldn't. He'd always get mixed up. So one day I just said, "Hey, it goes like this," you know, and I was already had picked it out on the guitar and home, you know. And
right.
So everybody was like surprised and said,
"How did you do it?
You know, how come you know that?" You know, so. Next rehearsal, he wasn't there, but the bass was, so I ended up playing both parts.
And this is an electric bass?
Yeah.
Okay. And then how did you make the move to upright bass?
Well, I think I was inspired by, I had a good friend of mine, local musician here, Johnny Carrasco, who was kind of took me under his wing, and we used to go to Circles, remember Circles?
Yeah, yeah.
Here in Phoenix. He was. He always had a nice car, and he had money, and so we'd go and because he worked at Reynolds Aluminum. I don't know if you guys remember that place.
Yep.
And he picked me up, and he lived on the west side of town, and not far from where I did. And so he'd come and get me, and we'd go to Circles and pick out Stevie Wonder tune, Earth, Wind, and Fire album. We had graduated to eventually to. Chick Corea on Return to Forever. I think mm-hmm. that's the one that really blew my mind. And
wow.
So Stanley Clarke. And before that, it was Herbie Hancock and Miles Davis, because, of course, Miles Davis played the trumpet. And so I was hearing all these great musicians at a very young age. We just, in my early teens. Yeah.
Now, you stayed on bass then for most of your music career. That was really your primary instrument.
Yeah, once I went to bass, that's really what I went on to just keep playing the bass. Mm-hmm. And I kind of left the trumpet behind. But
As far as the guitar goes, you kind of left the guitar behind for a while.
No, I think the guitar was always there.
Okay.
You know, we never really had a piano. My sister had a little pump organ, but I could never get... I wasn't motivated to the keyboard.
Right.
But the guitar was always there, and that was what we always, on the weekends after church, you know, my parents would go over to my godfather's or to an uncle's house, and there was always a guitar and an accordion, and and there would be maracas and bongos, and there would be music while the moms were making dinner, Sunday dinner, and the kids would be playing, but there was always music, and so that's kind of what inspired me.
Okay, now the first time that you and I met years ago at the old Chaton Studios in Paradise Valley, you were a bass player on a session. I don't recall the session. There were a number of them. I don't recall this first one.
I can't remember specifically.
I wouldn't worry.
Yeah.
But the thing that I took away from it, or I remembered about it, was the sound of your electric bass was really, really great, and you were a great player. And I remember at the end of the session asking you, what? I didn't recognize the bass. I'm like, what kind of bass is this? And you tell me you'd made it.
Well, it was kind of a hot rod, pieces of different, kind of a Frankenstein bass, I call it.
Uh-huh. Now, you had some experience with working with wood. You worked in a lumber mill, and
my father was a carpenter, and so I learned the trade, and I inherited some tools, along the way, and, my first hammer, so on. And at the time, I was also working for remodeling business, and I ended up working for another company here, World Timbers Incorporated, which had a mailing operation and commercial sales here in the valley. And so we had to identify over 100 different species of wood and know their properties and adhesives and finishes and everything that went along with how to work it, and because we were dealing with customers on a one-on-one basis. So.
Mm-hmm. Did that pique an interest in building instruments? Did you ever cut bodies out of wood and start to build
something? We used to deal, and we would sell suppliers. We were suppliers for a lot of the luthiers, here in the valley. Roberto Venn, they would come in and they would pick over all of the piles of
Best wood for their instruments.
Yeah. So and all their students and and ASU would come over and architectural students to build their models and whatever. And then we catered to the artisans in the valley in the Carpen.
So this was kind of the business that your father was in.
Well, it another level of it.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because pouring concrete in the summer with my dad, tying rebar and setting forms and foundations, that's really where I started.
Okay. There's a good job in the summer in Arizona.
Another reason to take music.
That's right.
It was good, but not that.
So you've had a few interesting odd jobs growing up, too. You're building gazebos was part of your gig.
Yeah, there was a time when we answered an ad in the paper right about the time I met my wife Melanie, and just before we got married, and so I said, well, I need to get a real job after, and I was also at the time working with Valley favorite Walt Richardson, so that was another kind of balancing act between trying to provide and as well. Maintain my.
So, is this right about the time you ended the work with Walt's band, or
was kind of simultaneous? I was whenever
you were
getting
married, retiring from that, moving.
We were
into
working at Anderson's Fifth Estate every Thursday,
right?
Until my son was born, and then that's when I kind of left the band. But we had toured Colorado, and at the time we were. The Frozen Star Tour.
Tell me about the Frozen Star Tour. We can come back to the gazebo building process.
Oh, my God. Well, at the time, I met Melanie and at Chewy's. You remember Chewy's?
Yeah,
the original
Tempe.
Chewy's on Mill Avenue.
Right.
And she was co-ed, working her way through college, educational degree that she was working on. And she was a waitress there. And I was working with a group called Phase 3, I think. We went to Phase 1, Phase 2, Phase 3.
Right.
But it was working with Carmel Ramirez. I don't know if you know
her. Uh-huh, I know Carmel.
And Linda Caldwell. They were the front.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred Forney, Steve Marsh.
All the guys.
Rick Benavides, I think Anita Padilla at the time. There was a couple of different keyboard players. Ralphie Chavarria was another great inspiration, a great musician. I was playing between Chewy's and the Century Skyroom and doing other... I was already doing different gigs at the time, but that's where we met. We would play over at Nancy and Jim Simmons owned Chewy's there. And we would... trade sets on Friday nights, and Walt would come in and do his I think he was Driftwood at the time.
Okay.
And I was with the girls, and we'd play there, and that's how we became friends and eventually got to know each other.
So that's after the tour, the Frozen Star tour?
No,
before the Frozen Star tour.
Before.
This is how you met Walt.
And that's how I met Walt.
Right.
Through Melanie, actually.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that tour, because every time you mention that tour, the big smile comes across.
Well, you ever see that? You ever see that movie? Or is it? It was used to be a TV series. It was called Ice Road Truckers.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, the Frozen Star tour was at the time we were working with Walt Richardson, and we had like a 10-piece band.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing
the Morning Star Band.
Morning Star Band. That's when it. Yeah, yeah. Walt Richardson and the Morning Star Band that was playing at Chewy's and Anderson's Fifth Estate. And then we ended up doing a LP, and then
and did a bit of national touring. Didn't
you? Yeah, they ended up doing national touring. They got some sponsors, and that was after I left the group. But Frozen Star Tour was. We started in Durango. Well, we'd go to Flagstaff. Play at Monsoons. I don't even remember Monsoons, Flagstaff. And then we'd go on, and this is in January.
Okay.
Okay, so Plato Jones decided, well, he's going to take us. He had connections in Colorado, and he loved to ski, so it was like we would always find ways to incorporate, what we love to do.
Right.
Skiing was one of his favorite pastimes. And so we went to Durango, Telluride, Steamboat Springs, Gunnison, not necessarily in that order, but we did a month-long tour a couple times, and then back again in the spring, and we go, you know, whitewater rafting and fishing for trout and stuff like that during the
day. Sounds like a fun trip.
Yeah, it was fun. But Frozen Star Tour was something that Plato put together for the band at the time. He was acting as a booking manager.
Right. And he went on from that project to do some pretty cool things.
He went on, well, he started with Redbone.
Mm-hmm.
Here he was from
Leon
here.
Redbone.
And I don't know if you remember Redbone.
Yep.
Come and Get Your Love. Right. The other one was, then he got picked up by Stephen Stills. And,
oh, cool.
Stephen Stills married a singer there that was Veronique Sanson, who was like Lady Gaga at the time there.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd come back, you know, whenever their tour was over, and then he always dressed like a rock star. He was, you know, but he always had like carte blanche here with Evening Star Productions. We ended up working at Compton Terrace as stagehands for a couple of different, it's another odd job there. You know.
Yeah, there's an odd job. In fact, let's get back onto odd jobs because there's a lot of material there. You were trimming trees for a while.
Oh, well. There was,
did a little bit of that.
We were just trying to make money. You know, teenagers trying to make money. And
did anything bad ever happen trimming trees?
Oh, my God. Yeah, we I won't mention any names, but we were trimming the old tamarack trees out in South Phoenix for a friend of mine had an older brother, and they had a property out there. And so he said, why don't you trim those trees? Because they're too close to the power line. Well, of course, you know, we knocked the power line down and I think all the power for several blocks around, and I think we ran away and hid somewhere. But that was very early on. So,
and you mentioned too, you had an odd job when you were younger, growing up, that dealt with building manholes.
Oh, well, the same friend.
Or modifying manholes. What's that?
Same friend, my compadre. Yeah, we used to work pouring curb and gutter. We setting, you know, stripping and setting forms for curb and gutter, and we graduated into building manholes. Now they're prefabricated.
Right.
Manhole is a like a big box made out of concrete with steel and and so stripping the forms on those is because it's, you're like in a box underground, and there's a piece of plywood with 2x4s holding up the inside of the top. So you know, once you pull the sides down, you're hoping that will drop, but sometimes you gotta kind of pry it down, and just when that thing comes down, it's comes down hard. So
I bet
can be dangerous, but we were having fun with it.
Interesting. And any other strange odd jobs growing up? Or I mean, it's a good lesson for musicians to know, you know, it's like the things you have to do to keep your art alive.
I've been a waiter, I've cleaned carpets, I've been a janitor, you know, you name it. Whatever it takes, you know.
Well, before we jump all the way up to you know, your music career these days, let's play a cut off of your last solo record, which is your first solo record, which we'll talk more about a little bit later.
Well, it's actually my debut as a vocalist.
That's right.
Okay,
that's right.
That's what it is.
Which is fascinating to me. But I guess since we're going to play it, let's talk a little bit about it. Not only is it your debut as a vocalist, but it really does feature you as a front man and as a guitarist and as a bassist.
And some percussion, too.
And percussion. Yeah. And I think that that's a real step from the back of the stage to the front of the stage for a lot of people who have known you as a side man or a bassist. Isn't that not accurate? Okay. Well, we're going to spin a track while I read that.
All right.
Here you go. This is off of the album, The Nearness of You. The cut, The Nearness of You.
Sensation, oh
true. I need no soft light to enchant me. If you will only grant me the right to hold you ever so tight and to feel
live.
And that was The Nearness of You from the album The Nearness of You by Felix Sains. Now, Felix, sounds great, and I love hearing your voice sing on that, which was new for me to hear you sing, because I was one of those people who probably had you in the box of, you're a bass player. That's mm-hmm. what I know about you. I only call you when I need a bass player. It had to be something to be stepping out with this record and being front man and singer and guitarist, and then to pick this material. You've probably played all of these songs with so many ensembles. How did you pick this song as the namesake for the record, or why, I should say?
Well, I think it kind of sums up the whole project. Was, you know, it's all romantic songs that, you know, were written long before, and in some cases long before I was born, but we all kind of grew up hearing these songs, and since it is about romance, The Nearness of You just mm-hmm. kind of, you know, had that ring, so mm-hmm. pretty much describes it.
And how many cuts are on that record?
There's actually 13 songs. There's 12 cuts, but one kind of morphs into another, mm-hmm. and the last song. So it did a play on the lyric and went into a different song at the end.
This wasn't the first time you'd been in a recording studio. Obviously, you've been as a sideman. Tell me a little bit about the process of making this record.
Well, what happened is, you know, summers slow down here
uh-huh.
quite a bit. It was one summer that I got a call, maybe 10 years ago. Somebody, an agent, called me, hey, do you know a guitar player who can play, you know, a couple hours for a wine tasting? And I said, yeah, I can do that. They didn't know that I did that. And
right.
I said, what? You don't even need an amp. I didn't even need an amp, you know. I think.
Right.
They said, they just need somebody to where they're playing instrumentals, you know. I just went and played. And it paid well, and I said, man, I need to do this some more. So I, at the time, you know, everybody was doing demos.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, in order for me to sell this to an agent or, you know, convince somebody to give me another, more of these type of gigs, I went into the recording, a good friend of mine, mm-hmm. Anthony Kinchon, has a home studio, and so he said, well, just want to do a demo. And it was, it just evolved into a whole nother thing, you know, because it was coming out of my pocket. And then that was like 2011, I think, when I actually went in. And I had been working with Dan Pinson on another project in his studio. And I met, we had done a quick tour to Hermosillo, south of the border. And I think it was Arizona State Commission of the Arts gig. You know, we were doing a jazz clinic and performance mm-hmm. Down there at the college in Hermosillo. And I met Jorge Estrada, who's a fabulous pianist.
Mm-hmm.
And we were working on a Christmas CD here. And then Jorge asked me, what are you working on? And I said, well, I'm doing a little demo. What songs are you doing? And then I told him, and I said, oh, I love that song. And I said, really? And I said, how long are you going to be in town? And so so in a period of, you know, 3 years after, you know, we kind of, every time he'd come into town, we'd go in and plug in another keyboard part.
Cool.
Over my guitar. And then after I heard the guitar and the piano together, I said, well, it'd be nice if I had upright bass on that. And so it just kind of...
So it started as a solo guitar demo to get gigs.
Yeah.
Kind of grew into this album.
A full project, yeah.
So you weren't even singing on the original demo concept. You were just playing guitar.
Well, I was...
singing a little?
A little bit, yeah. And so it inspired me to do more.
How's the record done for you? Have people been surprised? Have they given you decent feedback? What's been the reaction?
Mostly positive. A lot of people can't still get their head around it, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's been interesting because, you know, you can track, you know, what plays you get and stuff, you know, now that it's on, you know,
right, all digital,
all yeah. over YouTube and stuff like yeah. that. And I get a lot of hits out of Australia and Singapore, and it's like, really? Oh, okay, that's interesting, you know. But one of the most interesting ones, that's when my wife and I have a home in Wisconsin, and last summer I walked into a restaurant, and the owner were playing my CD on their house system.
Oh, neat.
And so, automatic gig, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I'm actually going to be going back there again this summer. So, but,
awesome. Now, in Wisconsin, have you ever played as a bassist, as a sideman?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they don't have, that audience doesn't really think of you as a bass player like this market does.
Well, they do. They know me as both.
Okay.
Yeah. But they've kind of accepted the other part better, mm-hmm. Easier.
Easier, yeah. It's difficult to make a change. It's difficult it's like any product.
Yeah.
When Xerox went from the copy company to the document company,
right.
You just get confused and you quit buying them because you don't understand
careful.
Them.
So by the way, I do still love to play the bass. And I do make, you know, my main living is playing the bass, and yeah. I love making people sound good. And that's really what my job is. So.
Yeah. No, I understand. That's funny. But it's, you know, when you do, and I got to tell you, you know, I can relate to the part that becomes fractured because people, when I came to town in 89, nobody knew I was a musician or singer because I wasn't doing it. I had done it before I moved here, but I'd been into recording. I came here, got a recording job, and I'm an engineer producer guy.
Right.
And it was years before anybody knew that I actually knew how to play an instrument and sing. I just kind of assumed everybody knew because we all do.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, you really realize a lot of engineers and producers aren't musicians, which is why they're on that side because it's their only way to play in music. And so I realized way late it was important for people to understand that I knew what they were doing so they would listen to me. You know,
right.
I knew what they were doing too because I played. And then started doing records, and I remember people were like, who's singing on that? Who's playing that? And it's like, me. And they were shocked at the concept, you know. And now getting into film, it's more fractured again. So now people are like, "Who knows? We don't know what he's doing. We'll never call him for anything."
We're always trying to break that ceiling, right?
So I just wondered. For me, hearing your record was well enlightening. I hadn't heard you sing before I heard the record.
I'm still working on it.
So
yeah,
that's pretty cool.
It's another instrument that I have to master yet.
It is. And speaking of mastering things, you've mastered being a musician parent with kids in the house for all these years.
Yeah,
and
two wonderful
kids. And also, you've managed marrying somebody when you were young and staying married the whole time. And for musicians, that seems to be a rare experience.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, married Melanie. Melanie is from Wisconsin. She moved here, and we fell in love and got married in 1985, May of 85. It'll be 33 years this year. Still in love. You know, we that's the reason for the CD. You know, it was all, we would, the CD is about, okay, when you're home after work, you're getting dinner together, you're opening the wine, sautéing the garlic, making dinner together, talking, you know, catching up. How was your day? This is the kind of music that we love to hear when we go out to have dinner, or you know, just home,
right?
You know? And so, make a fire, whatever, you know, and enjoy some good music. I would serenade her, you know, sometimes while she was cooking, and so I'd say, "What do you think of this song?" And she says, "Oh, I like that one." And she was, and after a while, she saw. I'd come home after being in the studio and say, "What do you think of this?" And she said, "Oh," after a while, she said, "I don't want to hear it till it's done."
That's right.
So anyway, I hope the novelty hasn't worn off. But
and she can appreciate music, and she's a musician as well.
Yeah, she plays piano very well, and her father was a jazz musician too. So she picked up the stride and boogie woogie piano for him.
Yeah, cool. That's very cool. And then you have a couple kids.
Amado and Felicia, both. My son Amado learned his ABCs at 18 months.
Okay.
We used to read stories to him while he was in the womb. He's a brilliant young man. Really proud of him. And my daughter also, a very talented artist and educator now, taking after her mother.
Awesome.
And she lives in Massachusetts. Just got married last May.
Okay, and either of them follow you in the music footsteps a little bit?
Oh, well, they both played music. My daughter played violin, and now I think she plays ukulele for the kids that she teaches now.
Okay.
And my son played cello, and it was a whole other education for me, you know, after he learned how to play classical music, and so made me bring out my old Pablo Casals albums and... And then we learned about Yo-Yo Ma and other great musicians of that generation. So,
and you'd pretty much learn by ear, just playing?
Well, I learned how to read music.
For the cornet, that's
correct. Yeah, and then it wasn't until years later that I picked up on reading the bass clef because I was... Well, that's another story. I don't know if we have time for that.
We got time.
Yeah. Well, if you want to know how I picked up the upright...
Because it's odd going to bass clef from treble clef.
It's a little different. Not so much, but...
Okay. I mean, I didn't like it. I kind of tried for a minute and said
no. Well, piano players do it all the time.
Yeah.
So, but going just from treble clef to bass clef was a little bit... I can actually still read treble clef better than I can bass clef.
Sure.
But I think what forced me to go to the bass clef and learn how to read was that when I was... we had just come off a tour. I was working with Linda and Carmela, and we were doing, I don't know if you guys remember, Charlie Johnson, who's an agent here that booked us in all the Hiltons in the Southwest here. And we used to do a month at a time, you know, five nights a week in Tucson or Albuquerque or, you know, maybe they'd sneak us in for a quick one at in Vegas.
This would have been in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s.
Kind it of. Was, yeah, late 70s, mid to late 70s.
Yeah. That's when I remember getting gigs that were week-long at the same venue, one yeah. band.
And then
that,
when we were in town, we'd play like Macayo's, and they had live music there. Mm-hmm. And then we'd go over to Fifth National Bank right on the corner there and listen to the rock band on our break.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of going on back in Phoenix in those mm-hmm. days. A lot more. Every hotel, every resort had a live band.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I lost. Where were we? I forgot. But we were talking about. What were we talking about?
I don't know. You took me off. Where did you go? That was good.
See, that's what happens.
That's all right.
So much to talk about.
But let me ask you this. You have had an opportunity to open for some pretty incredible people, too, or play on the same stage with some people like Art Pepper.
Art Pepper. Oh. Century Skyroom.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Bishop. That's where I met Dave Cook and Prince Shell and... I mean, I was playing other local clubs before then, Riverside Ballroom, Bridge,
right.
you know, Bridge Inn, and all the dives, and that's where I got my education
right.
as a musician. Art Pepper came about through Mary Bishop. She was hosting a jazz series here at the Boujum Tree, and at the same time, she was running the Century Sky Room, which used to be downtown,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the, which had been there for many years before I played there, and a lot of great musicians that were traveling through town at the time would stop there and jam and sit in and jam, and they hosted Art Pepper. It was the latter part of his life when he came in, and at that time, I was in my 20s. I didn't know who he was.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew that he was the sax player's idol, you know. And
right.
so we were playing some of his tunes, and you know, I already learned how to read bass clef. And thank we'll go back to. Oh, that's what we're talking about. We'll get back to that. But yeah, and so we played his music for a couple nights, and one of the nights is when. Dave Cook was sitting right on the first mm-hmm. table and was right in front of me. And on the break, he called me over and he says, "Hey, I got a gig for you." And at the time, I was working construction 5 days a week. I was playing a lounge gig over by Metro Center. And then I was teaching in Scottsdale at the guitar shop on Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
And so after my gig on, I said, "Well, I'm working Friday and Saturday already." And he goes, "This gig starts at 2 a.m. and goes to 6 a.m. I said, "Perfect." Right.
That's a gig.
So, and I did that for 2 years. But
where was that? Never mind.
It was kind of a secret place. You know, it was a speakeasy kind of place.
We'll read about it later.
Yeah, well.
In your memoirs when you write that.
Right.
That's pretty wild. So how long did you have that gig?
About 2 years. Dave Cook and Prince Shell, Virgil Lane, Bob Tate, Sleepy Carruthers was another guy. Mm-hmm. It was a septet, I believe. I can't remember exactly.
Mm-hmm.
At those late hours, you know, there was a lot of things that you kind of... But I was reading the charts that were written for me by Prince Shell.
Mm-hmm.
They were all written by hand. He had stacks of them. And Dave Cook and was their band, and so it was the best education I could have had at the time. It just, you know, opened my ears up and exposed me to musicians: John Coltrane, Dizzy Gillespie, Nat King Cole. It was, you know, Billy Eckstine, all these great artists their era,
right.
You know, like I said, it was from their era. Playing bebop tunes, you know, and they would call. I would go over to Prince Shell's house, and he would school me. You know, he'd write out the bass part, a simile or a modal construction of it, or anything to give me hints, you know. And then he'd record a cassette tape and say, "Here you go, take it home and listen to it, work on it," and then
I'd be ready for the next gig.
Interesting.
On the weekend. So that was my homework. Every time.
Well, when we were jumping off, we thought we jumped off of the bass clef learning your transition story. Yeah. So take me back there.
That's what happened. Yeah. Okay. So we had just come off the road, Linda Carmella from Charlie Johnson and gigs, and the group was going through a transition, so there was no gigs. And so another friend of mine who was working at Mr. Lucky's at the time, they took a tour.
Okay.
And so he had a job at Valley West Mall working for a Boston store as a shipping clerk. Another odd job.
Okay.
And I was in my early 20s at the time. And so I said, yeah, I'll take your job while you're gone. Well, I worked there for a couple years. And I got bored walking the mall on my lunch hours, and so I'd drive over to Glendale Community College, which was a mile away, on my lunch hour. And I wasn't enrolled, but I would sneak into the practice hall there, the music building, and there was an upright bass in there. And so that's the first time I actually had my hands on an upright bass.
Wow.
And so I would take it into one of the rooms, and I'd practice. And at the time, I was working on, I think it was I Wish by Stevie Wonder.
Okay.
On upright.
Wow.
Boom, 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 right?
What a story, though.
And so I was doing that, you know, for about a month, and then one day
somebody caught on.
Yeah, they busted me. So, and they says, I don't recognize you. Are you enrolled? And I said, no. And I said,
I'm just here to tune the bass.
Right. And he said, I've been listening to you for the last month. And it ended up being, I can't think of his name. Oh,
is this the instructor that was there?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And he says, well, I need a bass player for my jazz combo on Thursday nights. And he said, if you come, I'll cover your I'll give you a stipend to cover your books, and you can take the courses that I offer.
Cool. That's awesome.
And so I studied with him in his class at night school. For a semester, I took jazz improvisation and basic theory. And so I actually learned. Opened a whole bunch of doors for me. But
to me, that's an incredible story, because I love that good came out of something that required you to take the initiative. It wasn't something that was handed to you. It wasn't something presented like that. It was you just went and did it, and did it well enough that somebody gave you an opportunity because of it. You know.
Well, you know, it was a great opportunity. I'm very grateful for those many mentors along the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Angels, I call them.
And you played for another number of other people too. And I imagine every time it's kind of, especially when you're really young, it's kind of an awestruck experience to work with these people. But I think you mentioned that you'd worked with Herbie Mann at one point.
No, we opened up for Herbie Mann at Celebrity Theater.
Oh, okay.
That was Panacea was the group that I was playing with at the Century Sky Room. And that was Phil Paul and Camila Ramirez, Chuy Castro, George Carrillo, and Ralphie Chavarria, who was the son of Chepito Chavarria, another legend. And I've had the pleasure of playing in his band too. So
that's pretty cool.
Along the way,
I want to spin another cut off your record. We've been talking too much. I haven't taken the time to play the songs. We've got about 10 minutes left, so I want to play one tune, and then we'll come back and kind of wrap it up.
All right.
You tell me which one of these tunes you'd like me to share. One of them is When Sunny Gets Blue, or Mana Carnival.
Mana Carnival?
Yeah.
I think Mana Carnaval will be interesting because it's I sing it in Portuguese. And
I think that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So you sing in Portuguese, English,
Spanish, Italian, working on some French tunes. There's one song that I sing in Tagalog.
Wow.
So, you know, just inspired by Nat King Cole. You know, he was quite a guy. He would travel the world and he would sing to the people in their own language.
Yeah,
and I think that's a great way to, you know, open some doors.
At least a couple tunes every time when you go.
Sure.
Yeah. Fantastic. So this is also off of the Nearness of You CD, which is available on your website, which is
FelixSainz.com.
So that's FelixSainz.com.
Yeah.
And is it available on iTunes as well?
Yeah, it's CD Baby. It's out there everywhere. I you know, you want to look, it's out there.
All right, cool. Well, check it out. And that's Manya Carnaval.
Manya Carnaval.
Here you go.
listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
And that was Manya Carnival by Felix Sainz here on the Otto D Show. What an incredible piano part, too. And your voice in Portuguese, that's just beautiful. It's great work. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the team that was on that track.
Well, that was piano by Jorge Estrada. Well, and that was Alan Ames on guitar, I believe. Trying to remember back.
I know.
But on the album, I have quite a wonderful cadre of musicians there. It's very proud to have Alan Ames on violin, guitar, and he also played some mandolin.
Mm-hmm.
There's Joe Garcia on percussion.
Mm-hmm.
There's Fred Forney on flugelhorn, and Joe Corral on flute.
Some great players.
Yeah. So anyway, that song was also known as Black Orpheus, which was written by Luis Bonfa and Antonio Maria in 1959, with English lyrics also by Carl Sigman. It's a Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm.
There's a movie that was made, was called Orfeo Negro that year, and Carnaval. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with Brazilian music, and so that was one that I've been playing all along. You know, it's a jazz standard, so it's also known as A Day in the Life of a Fool.
Okay. Who can't relate to that?
Right.
Unfortunately, we are up on the end of the hour, so we're running out of time. Where are you playing next?
Well, tomorrow I'll play with 380.
Okay.
Trio 380 over at the Mayo Clinic Hospital on Mayo Boulevard for just an hour.
Okay.
And then we're doing the clinic up on Shea the following day. Thursday, I'm at Marcelino Restaurante with Seema and her band, Mark DiCozio and Sheila Early.
Cool.
And this Saturday, I'm playing at the Art Walk in Scottsdale with, and then later with Carmela Ramirez and her out at Premium Outlets, and then in Chandler. And then this Sunday, I'm playing the jazz brunch with Dennis Rowland, Diana Lee, and then after that with Beth Lederman at the Nash for the jam session. So it's a full week this year.
It is a full week. Long enough that we ran out of the end show music. Well, listen, thanks for coming in and sharing your story, Felix. I appreciate it.
It's an honor. Thank you so much.
We'll talk to you soon.